Thank you, Brian, for leading us in those songs. Psalm 34 and verse 14 says this: "Turn away from evil and do good. Strive for peace with all your heart." Psalm chapter 133 and verse 1 says this: "How wonderful it is, how pleasant for God's people to live together in harmony." Hebrews 12 and verse 14: "Try to be at peace with everyone and try to live a holy life, because no one will see the Lord without it." 1 Corinthians 14 and 33 says this: "Because God does not want us to live in disorder, but in harmony and in peace." Romans 12 and verse 18: "Do everything possible on your part to live in peace with everybody." What is your understanding of the word peace? When you hear the word peace, what kind of pictures come to your mind? What kind of ideas are there inside you? You know, I think that peace is something that's hard for us to understand, because we think of it in terms of war. We think of it in terms of, we're trying for peace in Afghanistan, we're trying for peace in Iraq, we've been trying for peace in Korea for years. And I think that that's one definition of peace, but I think that we need to look tonight specifically at two types of peace, and I believe there are two types of peace. Number one is this: the peace of accomplishment. The peace that you've done something, you've done the right thing, you've done it well, you've done it to the best of your ability. And when you're done with that task, when you're done with that project, guys, when you've got that big project at school that you've been researching, that you've been working on for weeks and weeks and weeks, and when you get it done, there's just a very peaceful feeling inside of you, isn't it? When you've got that project done, you can go to bed that night and you can actually sleep. And hopefully you're not up all night still working on the project. But you can go to bed and you have peace inside you. The peace that comes with accomplishment. The other type of peace, I believe, is this: the peace of laziness, of contentment, of apathy. The peace that you have that comes from doing absolutely nothing, because absolutely nothing is required of you. The peace of laziness. We talk about peace all the time in church, and there's nothing more desired in a church setting than peace. To be able to live in harmony with each other, to be able to get along with the other churches in your community. But there's also nothing to be more scared of than this peace of death. The peace that comes from a church dying inside. I want to preface our study tonight by saying this: with the understanding that you and I don't have the right, we don't have the ability to ever pronounce a church being dead, to ever say that that church is dead, that they're not doing anything, right. We don't have the right to make that judgment ourselves. So as we begin to examine this church at Sardis, I want us to look a little bit at its history. Let's look at its past. It was the center of five different roads. If you can imagine, like the spokes on your bicycle tires, there was a road that went northwest to the city of Thyatira, we talked about last week. There was a road that went straight west to the city of Smyrna. There was a road that went to the east to Phrygia, to the southeast to Philadelphia, and west to the city of Ephesus. So it was it was right there in the center. It was a big, it was the hub of the wheel. It was where a lot of people went to do their trading. And because of that, it was the ancient capital of the kingdom of Lydia, which I thought was interesting because it's home to the first coins, the first coinage that have ever been found in Asia Minor. Asia Minor. You can get it all out there. It was a city literally set upon a hill, like Jesus talks about in Matthew chapter 5. It was set up there. It was built kind of out on a point. It was built there, and off either side of it was just straight down, a few hundred feet. It was impossible to get up those hills. So it was almost impenetrable to any of the other armies, because the only way you could get to it was a little narrow path through the mountains. And we all know from the movie 300 that that's something that's very easily defended. But it was captured, which I thought was also interesting, by the Persian king Cyrus. He had been laying siege to the city for days and days and days, and had still, you know, not been able to get up that little narrow path. And so he finally offered a reward to any of his soldiers who could figure out a way to get up it, or a way to get there, to be able to conquer the city. And they came up with it with an interesting way. As they were observing all the cracks and all the crevices that were in the sheer rock face before them one night, a certain soldier saw one of the people of Sardis knock their helmet off the edge, and it fell down a couple of ledges. And he watched that man as he climbed down the wall, and then as he climbed down the edge of the cliff and got his helmet and went right back up. He made a mental note of the path that that soldier took. And he went and told Cyrus, and so Cyrus said, "All right, get you some guys together, and tomorrow night you're going to go up there." And that's exactly what they did. Sardis thought itself so safe that it didn't bother to post guards at night, because who's going to get up the sides of those walls, right? But somebody did. They got in. Nobody in Sardis even knew that it happened. They opened the gate, and the Persian army was able to come in unabated and take all that they wanted. A few years later, in AD 17, it was actually totally destroyed by an earthquake. There's nothing left of it, at least not much left of it. And you think that at that point they would have just let it die and said, "Okay, we're done with Sardis. We don't need it anymore." But at that time it was under Roman control, and the emperor Tiberius actually gave them a reprieve on their taxes for 5 years. So for 5 years, the city of Sardis didn't have to pay their taxes. And on top of that, the emperor Tiberius was giving them money to help them rebuild the city, to help try to return this place to its former glory. It was a great commercial center, and because of that, it was very wealthy. It's even rumored to have had a river that ran through it that actually had gold in it, that if you went out to it, you could pan for gold and all that good stuff. It was a very, very wealthy city because of its commercials, because of its commercial center, and because of this river. It was a great center in the wool industry of Phrygia, because the people there, they were great herdsmen. They herded their sheep. And when they would get the, when they would harvest the wool from that, naturally they'd get on that road and they'd head over to Sardis, and that's where they would sell their wool in the marketplaces. Sardis was also, like Thyatira, a dealer of dyes to be able to dye the wool and all that good stuff. It was, however, not a center of Caesar worship. We talked about that a few weeks ago when we were considering the church at Smyrna. How Smyrna was the one city out of all of Asia Minor that was chosen to build a temple to Caesar. And that was the center of Caesar worship. And the Christians there had a lot to worry about because of that, the persecution that they received from those people. But if they weren't the city of Caesar worship, they really would have liked to have been. But Smyrna beat them out for that. And in all this, all these good things, all these positive things that Smyrna had going for it, it had a bad reputation. When you said the word Sardis in ancient times, there would automatically be a look of, why would you go to that place, come to the face of whoever you were talking to? It had a reputation of contempt. It had a reputation of easy living, of being pleasure-seeking. You know, all the things that the New Testament condemns, all the things that it's against, that's what Sardis embodied as a city, as a whole, that was Sardis. So it's very easy to see why Christ would give them such a scathing review. I mean, if you haven't already, open up to Revelation chapter 3. The scathing review comes in verse 1 of chapter 3, where Jesus says, "To the angel of the church of Sardis write this. This is the message from the one who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know what you are doing. I know that you have the reputation of being alive, even though you are dead." The reputation of being alive, even though you are dead. Can you imagine? A few weeks ago we talked about that report card. This might be possibly the worst thing under that teacher comment part of the report card, where the teacher says, "Bryce talks too much in class, which is never a problem for me, by the way. You are alive, you have the reputation for being alive, and yet you are dead." I think it's also important for us to note that they weren't entirely written off. If you keep reading, verse 2, he admonishes them. He says, "So wake up and strengthen what you still have before it dies completely. For I find that what you have done is not yet perfect in the sight of my God. Remember then what you were taught and what you have heard. Obey it and turn from your sins. If you do not wake up, I will come upon you like a thief, and you will not even know the time when I come. But a few of you there in Sardis have kept your clothes clean. You will walk with me clothed in white, because you are worthy to do so." Not entirely written off. They had the name of being alive, but they were really dead. But in that death, there are a few people, however small a number that might be, that have not gotten their clothes dirty, that have managed to keep themselves clean in everything that's been going on. There's still a few embers in that fire that have been left burning. And with that, he says there is hope. There is hope for you yet. So I think the real problem here is not hopeless death, because Jesus hasn't condemned them to death. He's just said that you are currently dead. So it's not death, it's sleep. The real problem is not death, it's sleep. Have you ever fallen asleep while you were driving your car down the road? It's quite the scary experience. My uncle tells a story of a time when he did that. They lived in Tulsa. And one night he said he fell asleep probably a good 3 or 4 miles away from home. And he doesn't remember anything until he pulled in the driveway and woke up. How he managed to sleep for that long through all the lights and get himself there, I don't know. Maybe it's after you do it so long, you can get yourself there. But he got himself there, safe and sound, wakes up in the driveway, and he's home. I know I've done it a couple of times, probably the scariest time. I was coming home from school one time, driving through the hills and curves from between Van Buren and Mountain View, Missouri. It was almost like a roller coaster. I remember waking up as I was going around a corner, and I actually had not turned the corner and was driving off into the ditch, into the trees. It was a very scary moment. You know, you wake up all of a sudden, and your heart is beating really fast because you realize that you could have died very easily. Most of the time, being asleep at the wheel doesn't turn out that well for us, does it? These people, the people of Sardis, they'd fallen asleep. They were sleepwalking through their Christian lives. Can you think of anything more dangerous as a Christian? To be sleepwalking through your relationship with God? They were hoping, they were relying on their reputation and hoping that that would get them through, that their good name would get them through. And isn't that how it is in today's society? We rely a lot on names. It matters a lot who you're related to, who your parents were, especially when you're in school, when you're trying to play sports. It matters who your parents are, especially if you're in a small town. It matters whether or not your parents are on the school board. Now, it matters whether or not you've lived there all your life or you've just moved to town. Names tend to get people a long ways in life. And sometimes, I think in fact most of the time, we find that most of us don't live up to our names. That we don't live up to that great name that our great-great-grandfather put before us. We just can't. As hard as we try. But as we fall asleep at the wheel, those rumble strips, you know, that are there on the side of the road, probably some of the scariest things that I've ever hit in my life, especially if you go down Highway 60 towards Monette. I don't know why they put them in the middle of the road. But those rumble strips, they're there to help wake us up and get us going. You know, as weird as it feels in your car, it's part of that that helps make your heart beat fast and realize that, oh my goodness, I just messed up. I just about, you know, ran off the road or ran into that oncoming car. It wakes us up. It gets us going. And that is what Jesus is offering with this letter. He offers a rumble strip to the people of the church of Sardis. It is the opportunity to improve. Maybe to make their hearts beat a little bit faster. Maybe to make them sit up a little bit straighter in their chairs and say, oh my goodness, is that really what we are? Now here we've got all this going for us and we think that we're doing good and we're really dead. Is that really how it is? He offers the same thing to you and I. right now, tonight. He offers the same thing to you and I. If we find ourselves to be spiritually asleep, if we find ourselves asleep at the wheel, sleepwalking our way through our Christian lives, what a sad state of affairs. This was a great church in human terms, weren't they? They were obviously popular. They had a good name. The people in the city obviously thought very highly of these people. The other churches in the area obviously thought very highly of the church that was in Sardis. They must have had a great personality. You know, churches do have personalities. Some churches are warm and welcoming when you walk into the auditorium, or when you walk into those Bible classes and everybody makes you feel welcome and you just want to be a part of them. And other churches just have that cold, hard personality. When you walk in the door, you know, maybe somebody glances at you, they see, man, I don't recognize that person, and so they go off and find somebody else that they know to talk to. They're welcoming, they're engaging. They want you to be a part of that. Can you imagine as you walk into this church, all the people that would welcome you, you would want to be a part of that church, because to you and to I, it would be a church that was alive. And think of the programs. Think of all the things that this church would have had going. It would have gotten an A+ in programs. They would have been completely organized. You probably wouldn't have been able to find any better. They would have had it all going. It would have been working like a finely tuned machine, finely oiled machine. I don't know how it works. But that's what you would have found in the church of Sardis. And Jesus says to them, you have the reputation of being alive and you are dead. You know what that says, folks? That no matter what kind of show you put on, no matter how good the things that you do are, if you don't do them with the right attitude, if you don't do them in love, it means absolutely nothing. No matter how good you have going, no matter how good your program is. Today, you and I need this rumble strip. We need this opportunity, this wake-up call that God offers. You and I need this if we catch ourselves living in the past. If we catch ourselves living on all those things that this church and that whatever church has done before. If we catch ourselves saying, oh, you know, way back when I was a Bible school teacher, or way back when I was an elder. If we find ourselves saying, way back when I was baptized, you know, I was on fire. And since then, you know, I've been able to mellow out. I've been able to calm myself down just a little bit, you know. I don't want to be one of those radical on-fire Christians, you know, the ones who can't quit talking about Jesus. We focus on our former glory, on those things that we did before. If that's where our focus is, we need this. Today, you and I need this. If we're caught living for material things, if we're caught living for the clothes, Joe's talked about this a lot this morning, caught focused on the things of this life, we need what Christ has to offer to this church here at Sardis. Today, you and I need this if we're caught living for the form. What I mean by that is in our worship, in our lives. If we're so focused on the how, you guys know what I'm talking about. You have to have two songs and then a prayer. Two songs and a scripture reading, and then the preacher can get up and preach, and you probably should stand for at least one of those songs, right? And when those things don't happen, it's almost like a heart attack in the church, isn't it? We almost don't know what to do or how to act. We're like, we didn't stand up for the song before the sermon tonight. What are we going to do? You know what I'm talking about. If we're so caught up, if we're living in the form, we need what Jesus has to offer. Today, you and I need this if we're caught living for the systems. If we're caught living for the how, all the intricate workings of that fine-tuned machine. You know, you have your book of policies, and that book of policies is second, if it is second, only to this book right here. If we're caught living in that world, folks, we need a wake-up call. There's so much more to our lives than the policy book. The only policy book that should make any difference at all is this one right here. Do you need to hear God's wake-up call? Do I? Do we? We know for sure that the church here at Sardis did. One preacher writes this about nominal Christianity, this idea of falling asleep at the wheel, of sleepwalking your way through life. In nominal Christianity, he says this, "I'm convinced that there are many in our churches today whose religion is a burden, not a blessing, a weight and not wings, a load and not a lift, simply because it is rote and not real. For them, worship is little more than a reaction, a recitation of mere forms of speech. They do not enjoy it. They simply endure it. They have memorized certain phrases of devotion, but their worship is not personal and vital, and is therefore it is not exuberant and joyful. They recite the creed, but are not moved by its majestic meanings. They repeat the Lord's Prayer, but are not inspired by its implications for their lives. They sing half-heartedly the hymns, but never catch sight of their beauty and power. But still, many of them go on year after year, dragging themselves through the routine of a religion that is rote and not real. They stick to it because they believe that there is something right about it, but they are burdened, bored, and beaten. They miss the very place in life which should be the most hallowed and the most meaningful." Worship, this time that we have to gather together as Christians, as followers of Christ, should be some of the most meaningful moments in your week. It should be something that we look forward to and want to be there. Our Christian lives. You know what happens to us when we leave this building, when we go to our jobs, when we go to school? Those are the things that we're supposed to enjoy. Those are the things that we're supposed to hold on to and the things that we're supposed to look forward to. But these things are going to be boring to us. We're going to get bored until we meet Christ face to face. Until you stand face to face with Christ. Christ doesn't want a church like the one we find here at Sardis. He doesn't want a church that is dead. Here at Sunset, we have a great reputation among the local churches. Even further than that, we have a good reputation in churches, you know, way outside of Springfield. But that reputation is only as we are alive today. It's only alive as we are today and in the years to come. To ensure that we can take where we are now and keep moving in a positive direction, I want us to note two things. Number one is a personal thing. It's our relationship with Jesus. Do we call ourselves Christians? Honestly, do you call yourself a Christian? Do we know Him as something more than just secondhand? Is Jesus something that we're more familiar with than that neighbor across the street whose name we can't remember? We need to have that personal relationship with Jesus, that face-to-face meeting, and that only happens through prayer, through sincere study of His Word. And as a church, in churches where the Holy Spirit is missing, things just continue on as usual, like they always have, like they always will be, and like they are right now. You know what I'm talking about. They continue just as usual. Nothing different is ever done, because why mess with what has worked for years and 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 years, right? If we want to continue to be alive, we need to move past that status quo. We need to be able to move ourselves out of just sitting in the pews, out of just being comfortable with what we've got. We need to let ourselves be led. You know, I talked a little bit about that on Wednesday night in our devotional, about listening for the voice of God. When we come to those crossroads in our lives and we don't know what to do, we don't know where to turn next, we need to shut up and we need to listen for God's direction. We need to allow ourselves to be led by Him. We need to risk things beyond what we normally would and let God take control. Because without Him, we are nothing. Without Him, without our faith in Him to take us, to take whatever our new program is and run with it, we are absolutely nothing. If you're alive in Jesus, he closes us out in verse 5 by telling us the rewards. If you want to read with me, chapter 3 and verse 5. But a few of you there in Sardis have kept your clothes clean. You will walk with me clothed in white. Excuse me, this is verse 4. Because you were worthy to do so. Verse 5. Those who win the victory will be clothed like this in white. And I will not remove their names from the book of the living. In the presence of my Father and his angels, I will declare openly that they belong to me. The rewards. Number one, you get to be a slave. It doesn't come right out and say that. But it goes like this. In ancient times, only the people of great importance, only the people who meant something in that city, got to wear a robe that had any kind of color on it. If you were a slave, the only color you got to wear was white. That way they could tell you from everybody else. You get to be a slave. I like the end of verse 4. Because you are worthy to do so. Guys, we need to be able to be worthy to be able to walk with Christ like that. Number 2, our names will be in the book of life. Have you ever had this experience? You load up your family late one night after work. You get everybody packed in the van, in the SUV or whatever. And you take off on your vacation. You get to where you want to spend the night that night. You're absolutely exhausted and wiped out. And you walk in and you say, have a reservation for the Kidwell family. And they look right at you. They look you right in the face and say, we don't have that reservation. It's not in our books. Sorry. We're all full up. You're going to have to find something else. That's not the way it's going to be. Because our names will be in that book. He's not going to take them out. You will be acknowledged before the Father. Isn't that a great thought? And on that day of judgment, Tony Campolo puts it like this. He says, it's more like somebody's going to say, Ron Skates, Jesus, do you know him? Do I know him? He's going to pull out his wallet. And he opens it up and all his pictures are going to fall out. Your picture's going to be there and he's going to say, that's my boy right there, Ron Skates, I know him. Gene Bender, look, that's my girl right here. It's in my book. They're in my wallet. I know them. What an awesome thought for us tonight. The last question is this. Are you asleep spiritually? Do you need this wake-up call tonight? Do I need this wake-up call tonight? Do we as a church need this wake-up call tonight? If you find yourself asleep spiritually, wake up. Take advantage of this wake-up call. Wake up. If there's anything that we can help you with tonight, we ask you to please come as we stand and as we sing.